New York City. It's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, broadcasting live and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, you're going to hear from not one, not two, but six guests. This is a power-packed hour. We're going to hear from Professor George Kafinskas, professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine, talking about our spiraling individual and family debt crisis, from student loans to credit cards. Then a newsmaker guest, Alexis Baden-Mayer, on Monsanto's rider that passed in the Senate, the next steps. This is a call to action. Then there's a clip up on YouTube that many people sent me. I watched it. It's about 5 minutes long. It's a well-done clip. Alex Jones's reporter was able to ask Bill Gates a question. Bill was in Austin and talking about, you know, the polio vaccines and how his foundation is helping to eradicate polio. The exchange is informative. Now, normally it would be left there, but because of the research that we do here and our capacity for in-depth scholarly research, we decided to take it a step further. So Bill Gates has asked a question. What about the injuries from your vaccine that you've paid for and you're putting all over Africa? His response, it's only helping people. Without these vaccines, we would still have smallpox and polio. That's when the story gets interesting. That's when you will hear from a group of scientists who have studied with great detail just the polio vaccine. The other side of the story, the true story on the polio vaccine, from four experts, all women in their fields of expertise, highly respected, board certified, publishing articles in peer-reviewed literature. I would suggest that you reach out to people you know now and let them know that hopefully a correcting of bias, misinformation is going to happen on today's program. But we always begin with the latest on health and nutrition. Other things I had hoped to do today, including an article that really completely eviscerates the notion of herd immunity. Why herd immunity does not work. It's a lie. And also, who are the true progressives? An in-depth original commentary, as well as an in-depth original investigative report on Gardasil, the truth of what it actually is, what it does, what it doesn't do, how harmful it is. Those three are now posted today on my website. They're for you to use, download. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com, download them. But I'll comment on them tomorrow. First, we talk about the health benefits of a plant-based diet. Now, for many of us, that's all that we eat. We don't eat animal proteins. This is the latest from mainstream medicine. This is medical news published in the Journal of Hunger and Environmental Nutrition. And this was done at a Miriam Hospital in the Rhode Island Community Food Bank. Here's what they said. That when they taught people who were food challenged, meaning poor people, about the importance of making healthier selections and having greater access to nutritional foods for at least some of the days, that overall people began to make shifts towards a plant-based diet. And that meant using things like olive oil and legumes and pulses, like split peas and lentils, and less reliance upon what they would traditionally have looked for, meat and starches, and white rice and white flour pasta products and white bread. So here's the title of their article in Medical News Today. Adopting plant-based meals several times per week can improve food security and lower food cost. I really appreciate this, and I'll tell you why. because every day I'm counseling people who more often than not are financially challenged. And they join possibly two-thirds of the entire American population who are financially challenged. And a high number of those people, about one-third of Americans, over 100 million people, are so financially challenged that they don't have quality food. They also frequently live in areas where there's not a community garden or an organic food store. And those who live in urban areas, they're exploited with junk food in the different types of food outlets and fast food franchises in their neighborhood. The worst food in America is the junk food and the junk food outlets in urban America. So just imagine now that you learn about how to shop in a healthy way. You're going to save money. I took a gentleman off the street. His name was Victor. As you can see, Victor's more than portly. He's very heavy. And I asked him to go through the supermarket and, with his family, which is five people, purchase what you would normally buy on a weekly basis. Then tell me what percentage of your total income is that. For the average American, it's about 35%. I then went back through the store, selecting items and seasonings that would give him the same cultural identity to food, the same taste, mouthfeel. But the food cost almost one half what his bill was. I saved him 50%. More importantly, it was healing healthy foods. It could help him lose weight, help the health of his family. He was very appreciative. He allowed me to film him. That's actually in one of my documentaries. I think it's a shopping and cooking for good health, or it's not your fault, you're fat. It's one of those. In any case, this is what this study is showing. Now imagine if we did this. Imagine if at the community level, at the grassroots level, in every community in America, we went to the town councils and said, look, you have these abandoned properties. Why don't you tear them down and let us build community gardens where we, the community, will go out and we'll find individuals, foundations, or corporations who will donate money for greenhouses and organic heirloom seeds, and we'll teach local people how to sprout so they can then, in their own apartments and houses, they can sprout. That's very inexpensive. And how they can actually grow an awful lot of their produce, tomatoes, lettuces. There's over 150 types of lettuce, over 40 different types of sprouts, and microgreens, and starchy vegetables. They take longer, but that's fine. But in time, we could have tens of thousands of community gardens, especially in urban areas or in some of the dilapidated suburban areas, so people could be more food secure, save money up to 50%, and be healthier. It's that simple. And by the way, to help people in this audience, I've asked one of our staff to do nothing but help people in person, not over the phone, in person, learn how to make healthier food selections, what to juice, how to juice, what to prepare for meals, how to prepare, what seasonings that get you off of salt that still give you a salty flavor, how to lose weight. And we have three people now doing that. Larry, Sandy, and Nadia. You can call 212-874-4000. It's free. I pay them very well. I pay them better than a living wage with health benefits. So they don't charge you anything. You get it for free. Next up, excess salt leads to 2.3 million heart-related deaths worldwide in just one year. This is from the American Heart Association. And they're talking about 15% of all deaths due to these causes. And some of the heaviest nations with the highest amount of salt, Ukraine, Russia, Egypt, Qatar, Kenya, United Arab Emirates, and the United States, we're right up there in amount of people who die because we're eating too much salt. So what do we do if we want a salty flavor? It's really simple. First, there are a series of vinegars. There's over 40 different types of vinegars that you can use. And one of the best is simply apple cider vinegar. But there's also rice vinegar, and it's milder. And it's a smoother. And use Miriam with apple cider vinegar, and you get a wonderful zesty flavor. You can use toasted sesame seeds and lemon juice. And that gives you that mouthfeel, crunchiness, but salty flavor. Yet there's no sodium, there's no salt. And if you are going to have salt, always make sure that you have coconut water or potassium tablets or potassium-rich juice or smoothie. That helps balance. The more sodium you take in, the more potassium you have to consume. Otherwise, you end up with an imbalance in sodium and potassium. Finally today, a diet of walnuts and blueberries can improve cognition and help maintain brain function. Now, this is from Tufts University in Boston, done in association with the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Human Nutrition Research Center, and is published in a major peer-reviewed journal and presented on Science Daily. I'll quote it. Scientists are confirming that this age-old adage is worth following, and new studies show that diet may have implications for those who suffer from certain brain ailments. Diets containing 2%, 6%, or 9% walnuts were given to old rats and found to reverse several parameters of brain aging. And I suggest that we eat at least 4 ounces of walnuts a day. But also, you can find this is true for blueberries and strawberries. So berries and almonds, walnuts thrown into a blender. And by the way, what's really good in the walnut is alpha-linolenic acid, ALA, which is an essential omega-3 fatty acids, and also polyphenols that act as antioxidants and actually block the signals produced by free radicals that can later produce compounds that would increase inflammation. So have your walnuts, have your berries, and have a longer, healthier brain life. We're going to shorten our health and nutrition segment today because we have so many guests. Back in a moment with our first newsmaker. Go down to Washington, D.C. and say hello to Alexis Mayer. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks so much, Gary. It's great to be with you.
Alexis is a Washington-based lawyer and activist, now serving as the political director of the Organic Consumers Association. She is also the co-editor with the organization's director, Ronnie Cummins, of its newsletter, Organic Bites, B-Y-T-E-S. And she's had helped lead campaigns, including Millions Against Monsanto, Coming Clean to remove false organic claims for cosmetics, and Safeguard Organic Standards. Today, Alexis, we need to know the latest update on Monsanto's rider that passed the Senate, the fact that a whole lot of liberal and Democrats were really disappointed because they thought the Democrats on the important committees would stand up on behalf of the American consumer and clean, healthy food. And they didn't. They capitulated. So here's what I'm asking you. What did the Senate actually pass that's going to benefit Big Agra and corporations like Monsanto and DuPont? What happens to the bill now? Does it go through any additional votes or does it get signed by the president, become law? And what can we do? And also, this was no small effort. There were hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans made aware of this, and groups and organizations of every stripe went in to say, don't allow this rider in there. What does it say about the power of Monsanto and corporate America to reach in, craft the legislation, get it into the legislation, and get the legislation passed no matter what the public think. The forum is yours.
Thanks, Gary. So the Senate passed a continuing resolution. It's an appropriations bill to fund the government. It was put out by Senator Barbara Mikulski from Maryland, a Democrat, and the Democrats control the Senate as well. Attached to this very large piece of legislation that was essential to maintain the functioning of the government was a rider crafted by Monsanto that removes judicial review of USDA approvals of new genetically modified crops. So if the USDA acts illegally and approves a genetically modified crop that's going to damage the environment or human health, the judicial system, the courts, no longer have the power, now that Congress has passed this law, to review or reverse that decision, even if our health and our environment are at stake. So it, unfortunately, the bill was also passed by the House and now has been signed by President Obama. And so blame really lays with the sponsor of the bill, Senator Barbara Mikulski. And it's hard to place blame, you know, blame just lies with the entire Congress. They did not allow an amendment to be voted on to remove the rider. Senator Tester from Montana, who's an organic farmer, submitted an amendment, but it was rejected by the Senate leadership. So, you know, Monsanto, they give money to both parties, and they spend a tremendous amount of money lobbying Congress. They have inordinate power. And hopefully we can prevent this from happening again. The rider only lasts for the length of the continuing resolution.
Why not? I know it lasts for 6 months, but mm-hmm. why not simply start a process that we can control? Alexis, I'm a little different in my thinking from many people in the movements. I don't believe that we're going to do anything that's going to do any good as long as the power behind the legislators and the wealth that they have to share and the promises of jobs and consulting positions is so great that we can tempt people back to a moral position. I just believe our entire Congress is no longer looking after our interests. So why not just do it the reverse? Forget Congress. They're corrupt to the bone, and we all know it. They're sociopathics. That's my personal view. I'll call them a sociopath. I don't like any of them. I don't trust any of them. I don't trust anything that comes out of Washington. I believe that you're all working in one giant cesspool. I don't care how many roses you put around the cesspool. It's still a cesspool of corruption, influence peddling. But then they live in their own reality. Why not we start only buying organic, only buying certified organic local farming, only buying clothes that we need that are made by people who were not enslaved to make them. No Bangladesh clothes, no China clothes, no Haitian clothes. Stop buying crap we don't need. Turn off MSNBC. Turn off any show that is pro-corporate right or left. Stop voting for these clowns. The very people who today could be victims of a genetically engineered food that may get into our systems and have no one able to stop it, therefore Monsanto has greater power than our entire judiciary system, they don't care about us. So why should we vote for them? Why don't we become just try to get ourselves off their grid, tear up their credit cards, shop with only green and sustainable in mind, start going towards a different lifestyle. Why can't we do that instead of thinking, as unfortunately some people in Washington do, that if we just write enough letters, or if we show up and demonstrate, or if we lock hands around the White House and get arrested, somehow these people of no conscience and no heart, no soul, no spirit, are going to wake up and say, my God, look out there. Look at all these people. You know, they're concerned. Maybe I should go out and talk with them. That isn't going to happen in our lifetime. That's my point of view. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, you're speaking our language. That's exactly the message of the Organic Consumers Association. That's why we're called the Organic Consumers. We think that the best way for you to take control of your health and protect the environment is to get involved in organic. And I really appreciated your comments earlier on your program about how inexpensive that can be when you do things at home and when you shop for low-cost but high-value nutritional products.
Give us your website, please.
organicconsumers.org.
Alexis, I'm going to call you back when we get close to the end of this particular piece of legislation's lifespan in 5 months and see if we can't do something to, of course, the heads of so many unions are corrupt, even though their membership is frequently loyal and ethical and honorable. But maybe we can start generating enough concern about Monsanto to have a boycott of any product or anything that they're associated with, we boycott. That'll get someone's attention. It seems that the only thing that gets attention is when you stop sending them money. We'll be back in touch with Alexis in the near future. Let's now go over to our next guest, standing by in Brooklyn, New York. He is George Kafetis, professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine in Portland, where he focuses his research on the philosophy of money and science and technology. He's also written extensively on economics, labor, and energy crisis, and debt and capitalism. And he received his doctorate from Princeton University, and where he has been involved in grassroots debtor organizations such as Occupy Student Debt Campaign and Strike Debt that emerged in the aftermath of the Occupy Wall Street movement, the latter which has already managed to buy and cancel debt worth about $1 million, much of it a medical debt. His latest book is In Letters of Blood and Fire, Work Machines and the Crisis of Capitalism. And there's also a Debt Resistors Manual available free on the Strike Debt website, strikedebt.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Okay, it's great being here, Gary.
I'm very concerned about not the federal debt, because unlike Cyprus and unlike the European Union, they can't print more euros, all right? And they can't use their own currency. In the United States, the Federal Reserve will never go broke, nor the United States government, because they can just continue to, one can demand money, the other can print money. But companies go broke, individuals go broke, states or municipalities within states can go broke. And yet we now have a phenomena, and this is my point I'd like for you to address. We have a phenomena of contradictions. On the one hand, all of the money that was given out, first in secret, $16.1 trillion that only Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders uncovered in their efforts at auditing the Fed, that all went in 22,000 transactions to a group of corporations, and the top 20 were almost all banks or Wall Street firms. And it was in high amounts, $2.3 trillion, $2.1 trillion, $840 billion. Now, that money, which was first in secret, we only find about later, that is separate from quantitative easing 1 and 2, or the initial bailout. All of that money went so they could use it in arbitraging, in derivatives, in buying up competition, in lavish salaries and bonuses. So I did some homework, and I found out that they didn't save a single home from being foreclosed. They didn't take the banks that got the money and say, look, your home is worth $200,000. Your mortgage is $400,000. You're not going to be able to pay your mortgage. You're going to go in debt. So why don't we bring down the cost of this mortgage from $400,000 to $200,000, and then let's negotiate with you. You've got an 8% interest. It's double-clicked up. Let's bring it down to 2% so you can stay in your house. That would have saved tens of millions of Americans from suffering. They could have gone to the students and say, you're now at $1 trillion in student debt. You cannot get out of it in bankruptcy because we owned the Dodd-Frank people, all the members of Congress, and we made sure that we excluded bankruptcy from student loan. And also, by the way, we managed through ALEC and your state councils to get private for-profit corporations in 27 states to re-enter you into the debtor prison. So if you don't pay your bills, we'll come and arrest you with private security people, we'll put you in a private jail, and then we'll charge you compounding interest every day that you can't pay us, even though you're broken, that's what got you there. All of this is going on in clear view. None of this is a cabal. None of this is a conspiracy. They don't have to conspire to do anything. They've screwed us so royally, and we seem to be like the frog that the water's starting to boil, and we're unaware of it. I'm saying, what can we, the people, do to address these crimes against we as citizens before there is nothing but debt peonage existing in the land. Those are my thoughts. Challenge me in any area that you wish. The forum is yours.
Well, on the contrary, I think that Strike Debt, the organization that I'm a member of, has been very much brought into existence because of the basic inequality and unfairness that has been part of the financial system bailout that occurred beginning in 2008. You're quite right, Gary. In that year, trillions of dollars passed hands from the federal government to financial institutions, and not a penny was diverted to ease the debt burdens of the millions of people who are facing foreclosure, huge student loans, and medical debt. So what Strike Debt has begun to organize is, and started last summer, is in response to this evident unfairness. And basically, we have been have as a long-term vision the view that we have a society right now that in order to satisfy the basic requirements of life, that is health, education, and housing, and nowadays, in order to satisfy these basic needs, one has to go into debt and to a form of debt peonage.
George, we have a bad phone connection. Please hang up. We're going to call you right back. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We'll reconnect with my guest. Back, and George, sorry we had that little technical glitch. Let's go into what is the phenomena of so much debt, and why do you believe that so many people keep participating in this debt cycle? I'm asking everyone now, before you go any further in your graduate studies or studies, ask yourself, are you aware that right now, and for the past 6 years, millions of people have been brought into the United States by major corporations with PhDs in engineering and science to take the place of Americans who have worked hard, gotten their degrees, and built up some seniority and expertise, and they're being fired so that someone can work for half the wages and none of the benefits, and this is under a fully legal visa system, and yet we're not told any of this. We're not told. We're not being honest that when you graduate, even with a good education, that you may not be able to find work to pay back the debt, in which case then the debt is going to increase. Talk about that. Talk about the fact
that... Well, I would say that what's happening in the United States right now is something that is not due to immigrant labor. It has to do with the fact that, in general, the power of people versus their employers has dramatically been reduced. And, for example, it's the possibilities of organization in labor unions, for example, has been tremendously been under attack, so that now only a very small percentage, about 8 or 9% of the workforce, is organized in a collective way. So increasingly, what workers in the United States, both well-educated and not, are facing many these deep difficulties and are facing the fact that in order to satisfy their basic needs, they have to go into debt. This is our view in Strike Debt is that the key is first we need to develop a recognition that debt has a very special psychological effect upon many of us. We're afraid to talk about debt. We're afraid to say to others that we are in deep trouble around our debt. So one of the most important questions that Strike Debt is trying to confront is how can we begin to change the discourse about debt so that people begin to realize that they are not alone, that they are very much part of a whole system that involves millions of people who are being separated from each other by this shame and guilt around debt that we are anxious to try to break down.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense.
We published a booklet called The Debt Resistors Operations Manual that's available at our website, www.strikedebt.org. And it's a book that's one of our first steps in trying to break down this lack of knowledge of what is happening with debt and why people are getting into debt, number one. The second thing that we're doing is that we have developed a procedure that we think is very important and can highlight the situation that all of us face. We call it the Rolling Jubilee. And the Rolling Jubilee is based upon a sort of loophole that we've discovered in the debt economy. And if I'm going to just spend a minute to explain this loophole, it's the following, that when a debt goes into default, let's say we're dealing with medical debt. Let's say a hospital corporation has an emergency room person who is in debt and has not been paying, is in default. Often the hospitals sell that debt, let's say it's $1,000, sell that debt to debt collection agencies for pennies on the dollar. Okay, so if it was $1,000, often they sell it for $50, 5% of the debt, and so the debt collectors buy the debt at these dirt cheap prices, and then go after this unhappy debtor, and try all the tricks in the book that they're quite used to terrorize, to harass the debtor as much as possible in order to squeeze out maybe not even the whole full $1,000 that is owned, but anything more than $50 as far as they're concerned, a gravy. So they push and push and push. But a lot of people don't know that this is what's going on. But we also have figured out that it is perfectly legal to form a nonprofit organization that enters into this secondary market, which buys debt, and basically buy that debt, pennies on the dollar, and then turns around and instead of harassing the debtor, canceling the debt as a gift.
That's a very noble thing, and I very much appreciate all the good work that you're doing. And we certainly support your organization and people getting information, what they can do to help them when there is a debt crisis. The website is strikedebt.org. The latest book in Letters of Blood and Fire, Work, Machines, and the Crisis of Capitalism. My final thought on this is that I believe that those in power at the multinational level, at the banking level and our government level, are fully conscious that those who are in debt are in all probability never going to get out of it because of how they control the laws, they control interest and how much interest and compounding interest and late fees that a person could be stuck with. I believe they know this for housing, for education, and for health care. And for years before the crisis, the number one reason for bankruptcy in the United States was because of medical bills. And I believe that we, until such time that we're evolved enough as a society to have leaders that are evolved enough to have a single-payer coverage, then we will continue to end up having people go broke and not get better medical care because of it. I also believe that what our policies are directly leading to the ghettoization of the suburban environment as it was for the urban environment for a long time, and I do not believe that these people care a whit about what happens to people once they get into debt. And I believe that because they benefit from debt, they profit from debt, that they have no reason to change their policies. All the more reason why we should ask ourselves, do we need to buy a home? Do we need to indebt ourselves? I don't believe we should. I believe we should be getting out of every debt we can, sell what we have, get liquid, tear up their credit cards, get out of their banks. I believe that's an important step as well. And by the way, I will send you over, George, the articles that I have, the scholarly articles I have, of how many fully legal people are coming into work in the United States and taking away very high-quality jobs. I'm not talking about lower quality. I'm talking about high-quality jobs that not only are we getting hit with no good unionization any longer, but high-quality jobs that people felt secure in. They felt they would have a future, could maintain a standard of living. Those jobs are being taken over by people who are also qualified. And I don't blame them. They're coming from countries where they don't have the same opportunities, and they look at America. Hey, you're paying someone $100,000 a year who's been there for 20 years, and you can pay someone else $35,000 and none of the benefits. That's the way American corporations are going. And we actually have a tape from one of the meetings that was packed with corporate representatives and a law firm that brings these people in. And there's not a word about this anywhere. Thank you very much, George, for all your good work. My guest, George Kaffentzis, Kaffentzis, professor of philosophy. Now, quickly, we're going to go to a confrontation between Bill Gates and a reporter for InfoWars about the polio vaccine just brand new, held in Austin, Texas. And then we will respond and show you the other side of the story.
Multiple overseas media outlets have reported on the fact that polio vaccines linked to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and his Gavi Alliance have on record caused nearly 48,000 children in India to suffer neurological damage and become permanently paralyzed. Most recently, over 50 African children from Chad also began convulsing after receiving a Gates Foundation-funded meningitis vaccine that specifically targets African people. Those children, some as young as 7, have also subsequently become paralyzed. Yesterday, Bill Gates appeared at a highly controlled speaking engagement to address computer science majors at his new Bill and Melinda Gates Computer Science Complex building on the University of Texas campus. I was able to purchase a ticket from a student and attend the meeting. Though no cameras or recording equipment were allowed inside the meeting, fellow reporter David Ortiz was able to capture a live stream being fed to an adjacent room. When the floor got open for questions, I decided to ask Mr. Gates a real one.
As a mountain with InfoWars, what do you say to critics who claim your global vaccination program is nothing more than a eugenics program?
A huge...
eugenics. Over 48,000 children in India have been paralyzed due to polio vaccines linked to your foundation.
No. I mean, nothing has saved more lives than vaccination. The key figure that we think about in terms of what we're prioritizing is the tragic death of young people. But if you go back to about the time I was born, more than 20 million kids under 5 were dying every year. Smallpox, measles, a variety of things. By 1990, even though the number of children were, because the population growth had gone up, that number had come down from over 20 million to about 12 million. And because of the work that the foundation has been at the center of, we now got that down from 12 million to less than 7 million. And the goal is to get it down to well under 3 million, by which time the disparity between what happens with poor children and what happens with rich children will have largely been eliminated. So, vaccines are about saving lives, improving lives. There's no better tool that mankind's ever invented for absolutely those things. And, polio, the whole idea is to reduce to zero the number of kids who are being paralyzed. And it's during between now and 2018 if things go well, we expect that will become the second disease ever eradicated. Smallpox, back in the 1970s, by 1979, that was certified as the very first and so far the only disease that has been eradicated. So we're pretty close on polio, but what it's about is every year having less and less kids who either die or are paralyzed. Last year it was 232.
Not only did Bill Gates fail to directly answer my question, but let's review. Mr. Gates' father was a known eugenicist and the head of Planned Parenthood. He admits in this clip from a 2003 PBS interview with Bill Moyers that he likes to focus on population control.
An issue that really grabbed me as urgent were issues related to population, reproductive health.
But did you come to reproductive issues as an intellectual?
When I was growing up, my parents were always involved in various volunteer things. My dad was head of Planned Parenthood, and it was very controversial to be involved with that.
He went on to say, and maybe the most interesting thing I learned is this thing that's still surprising when I tell other people, which is that as you improve health in a society, population growth goes down. In the past, Mr. Gates has openly advocated withholding end-of-life care to the elderly and using those funds to instead hire more teachers.
And so the access that used to be available to the middle class or whatever is just rapidly going away. That's a trade-off society is making because of very, very high medical costs and a lack of willingness to say, you know, is spending $1 million on that last 3 months of life for that patient, would it be better not to lay off those 10 teachers, but that's called the death panel, and you're not supposed to have that discussion.
And he's also announced that the goal of vaccines is to reduce the population by 10 to 15%.
So let's look at each one of these and see how we can get this down to zero. Probably one of these numbers is going to have to get pretty near to zero. That's back from high school algebra. But let's take a look. First, we've got population. The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
So what does it matter if 48,000 children suffered permanent neurological damage and were paralyzed if it's in the name of philanthropy? But the problem is these vaccines have actually been shown to cause the very diseases they're supposed to prevent. Bill Gates is a billionaire technocrat obsessed with population control and the idea that vaccinating the world is doing, in his words, God's work. But who's God and at what cost? Trading lives for lives? What kind of world is that? When we devalue one human life, we devalue everyone's life.
What we're going to do now is share with you some very scientific, but easily understandable and purely scholarly comments of women physicians and scientists who have looked into the question of the polio vaccine. And the first two people you're going to hear will be Janine Roberts. She is possibly the most important investigative journalist of the last half century. She's been a major voice in British journalism and documentary filmmaking for decades. Her films on human rights issues, including the colonization of Aboriginal Australia, the gold and diamond trade, blood diamonds, terrorism, and the history of vaccines. She's done all this. And you're going to hear from her. Then you're going to hear from Dr. Susanna Humphreys, board-certified nephrologist and internist, and who studied the role of vaccines, particularly and specifically the polio vaccine.
There were epidemics of paralysis that were occurring in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and they were predominantly occurring in children, but they were also occurring in adults. In fact, FDR, one of the most famous polio victims or alleged polio victims, was, I believe, 40 years old when he contracted his paralysis. This is these paralytic cases occurred in the summertime as opposed to the majority of viral illnesses, which will occur in the wintertime. They tended to occur in the summertime after people were eating a lot of fresh fruits that were recently harvested, possibly diseased, and also sprayed with toxic chemicals.
20 years, parents have been told that an unknown virus caused polio. The children dying every summer were said to be dying of a virus that no one had found yet. They were told, kill flies, because the flies must be getting them infected. Other scientists, which I'll come to, were actually working and curing polio patients. I didn't find out this at first, because I believed that it had to be a virus because the vaccine has stopped the polio epidemics. After all, no one ever hears about a polio epidemic in the United States now. For 2,000 years, we've known that lead and arsenic cause paralysis, that when dogs are exposed to lead or arsenic, they get the identical symptoms that are happening during the polio epidemics. During the American polio epidemics, geese, sheep, farm animals were being paralyzed. Farm animals are not as susceptible to the blamed polio virus, that they can't get infected by it. Yet, it happened during the summer. And what were people doing during the summer? What was new in the United States was the introduction of a pesticide to kill the codling moth, lead arsenic. It was sprayed every summer, 12 times, on the apples. The apples were so dangerously polluted that the United Kingdom forbade them to be imported from the United States. Well, after the Second World War, DDT was introduced to kill. Now, how do they kill insects? They paralyze them. Did we ever think they're paralyzed? No, because we only safety tested it for 1 or 2 weeks. Toxins accumulate. All toxins, metals, go through the blood-brain barrier and can accumulate in the fat inside the brain. Constant exposure builds up critical levels. These toxins accumulate. The children get paralyzed. This was so well known. The kids are falling ill, and parents were saying in New England, I got the state reports, they said, we can't understand why our kids are falling ill. They eat lots of fresh fruit. Doctors, the chief inspector in New Hampshire said it can't be an infectious illness, because it's only the children eating fruit that are falling ill. It was ignored by the health establishment that was fixated on the virus theory, the germ theory of disease.
The forces at that time pretty much eliminated any other possibility of what was causing paralysis in children and in adults back then, despite the fact that there were highly qualified people testifying with a lot of documentation in front of Congress that it could have been the arsenic and it could have been the lead and it could have been the mercury and it could have been the DDT, and that in detoxifying people actually cured the polio, it cured their paralysis. This was all ignored, and the band marched on with regard to fundraising and vaccine development. And once that belief system was put in place, it was very difficult to go back and undo that. But still, to this day, even though most of the scientists who were opposed to identifying a virus as the cause of the paralysis are now dead, they left a lot behind as far as books and journals that is easily brought back out to show that there was a problem back then in jumping to the conclusion that a virus was causing the paralysis in children.
Parents didn't know any of this. So middle-class families were putting up wallpaper pre-soaked in DDT on the walls of their children's bedrooms. They were spraying everywhere because they believed it was a fly carrying polio virus that was to blame. They didn't get polio, and the middle classes did. It says, middle-class children are not exposed to dirt like working-class children. The working class children went out and ate some of the soil. The soil had the polio virus in it and made them immune to life. That's quite likely. But I'm sure that most middle class parents also let their children play in the garden. I don't know any middle class families anywhere in England or in the United States that don't do that. This would give their child immunity to life. Most American children before the epidemic, during the polio epidemic, were immune to polio virus. In Africa, 80% of the population was immune to the poliovirus before vaccination. Because a child ingests this in his early months of life, and the immune system kicks into life and grabs immunity to 1,000 toxins. We're gifted by nature with fantastic immune systems.
Then the question must be, how is the polio vaccine manufactured? This is startling. Again, Dr. Susanna Humphreys and Janine Roberts.
Well, I actually started my research on polio when I was flown to the NIH by Channel 4 in England, one of our larger television stations. It was because of reports that a monkey virus had been found in the polio vaccine and is now being found in human cancers. So the first question I had to ask was, how on earth did a monkey virus get into the polio vaccine? So I had to research. So I started to look up and find out how they made the polio vaccine. Now, I found out that the polio research is a project, the Manhattan Project of Virology. It's where all the modern vaccines were invented, where they all come from. I went to the World Health Organization. I said, well, when did you first discover the polio virus? And they said, oh, it's a famous experiment. It was done in Vienna in 1908 by two Austrian scientists. So I went and read up the details and found they got two monkeys from Sigmund Freud, who was studying them to see if they were more intelligent or less intelligent than humans. And they took these two monkeys and they got from a child who died of polio the backbone. They ground up this backbone and made a 20% suspension of this backbone. They put particles of bone, human bone, into a fluid, suspended in the fluid, and they injected it through the skulls into the living brains of these two monkeys. They said it must be in this fluid because, look, we've just paralyzed the monkey. They just put diseased human backbone with all the possible toxins, debris, everything into the brains of another species. And it gets paralyzed. Well, it's not really surprising.
But they couldn't paralyze the monkeys by feeding them these concoctions, and they couldn't paralyze the monkeys by just injecting it into a muscle. So they determined from this very crude experimentation and very unnatural simulation that there was a virus, even though they didn't have an electron microscope even developed back then, but that there was a virus that was causing an infectious outbreak, and that developing an antibody to that virus was going to be the solution to the paralysis.
Your Rockefeller Institute, well, they did exactly the same, and then they took some of the fluid from the paralyzed monkey's brain and they injected it into another monkey, whereupon that monkey was paralyzed. And they said, Eureka, we've now proved it's infectious, it's spread from monkey to monkey.
So they developed the vaccine. And the first vaccine that was developed was actually a complete disaster. It was in 1935, and one of the scientists' name was Brody, and there was another scientist with him. And they developed a vaccine, and it immediately was causing paralysis in people who it was administered to. And it was very embarrassing for the government and for the vaccine creators, and they stopped. And people were afraid to keep going for about 10 years. But then Jonas Salk came onto the scene. And he was brought in as a virologist, and he was funded by the money from the March of Dimes that was created by FDR and Basil O'Connor. And with that funding, he was able to open a lab and start typing what he thought was the virus and start injecting it into monkeys and seeing what kind of antibodies formed and start to follow what pathology they thought it was. So, you know, the mythology of infectious agents causing paralysis was continued with all of this research, despite the fact that nobody has still ever proven that this entity that causes paralysis is communicable among families. And even if you look at the old pictures of the iron lungs, you'll see that in most cases, nobody's gowned, nobody's masked, nobody seemed to be afraid of contracting polio.
For the next 20 to 30 years, they still kept hunting for a cheap way to make a vaccine. They imported over 20,000 monkeys, wild caught monkeys, from India, Philippines, West Indies into New York. Many of these monkeys died en route. And they took their testicles and their kidneys, because an amateur surgeon can get these organs really easily. They pulverized these and put them in an incubator, and they tried to find a way of growing the polio virus that infects humans in these monkey cells. It just costs too much, though. You know, importing monkeys is a highly expensive business. And it wasn't until 1948 that here in New York City, they worked out how to make a cheap polio vaccine. At a New York hospital, two doctors took the excrement from children with polio, and I quote, they took a 20% suspension of excrement and injected this into the brains of mice that were 3 days old. When these mice were paralyzed at having human excrement injected into their brains, they went, "Eureka, the polio virus must be in the excrement. It must be a gut virus." They then examined the guts of these children and found a small spiracles virus in the guts and said, "Eureka, there's a polio virus." The vaccines we use today are the direct descendant of that experiment. The ancestor to the polio virus they're using is a human gut virus found in the excrement of children.
What would you imagine would happen to any human being if you took excrement and injected it directly into a brain? You would paralyze the person. That is the crude level of science behind this entire scheme. Now let's hear from Dr. Tony Bark about what she believes is the real reason the polio was conquered and also general ways disease were eradicated historically.
You know, many people, even if they talk about the dangers of vaccines, will mention, you know, they'll preface, "Oh, but, you know, vaccines have saved us from all these diseases that were killing us." And I actually believed that for a long time. And I didn't start to question that. And so I started, you know, looking at some of these graphs. And, you know, again, one of the things was in the 1900s, people died of scurvy, people died of tuberculosis, people died of yellow fever in this country. They died of scarlet fever. We never vaccinated away tuberculosis, yellow fever, scarlet fever. I use those as examples. People aren't dying of them in this country, right? And we didn't vaccinate away against it. Part of it is that we have better health from better nutrition, from fresh water, access to clean water, access to great sewage water reclamation and sewage treatment, and central heating. So we have much better nutrition, and people stopped dying of tuberculosis and yellow fever and scarlet fever and some of these other things, and they stopped dying of scurvy. But I know my parents would say when they were young kids, many of their friends lost parents to tuberculosis, they'd go to sanatoriums, right? Well, we never vaccinated away against these diseases, and they are gone from our country. They are gone from most countries unless there's poor nutrition and a lot of alcoholism and high autoimmune, immune deficiencies. So we don't really see people dying of these things in first world and even second world countries where there's good nutritional status and access to clean water. And that is the key point. We don't have a historical record of polio outbreaks in the 1600s or 1700s. We didn't see polio really until we started giving the diphtheria tetanus vaccine. Now, it could be one of two things. It could be that, you know, the polio virus exists and it's endemic. It was endemic and it was something that it was normal flora in effect. I mean, in 99% of the cases, it didn't cause any problems. But it could be that receiving a vaccine weakened innate immunity, and then you were exposed to it, and maybe you hadn't been exposed when you were an infant because you hadn't been to the lake or you hadn't just been exposed to it, and then it was more damaging for you. It also could be that we saw Guillain-Barré from these vaccines, and so really what we were seeing was Guillain-Barré, which of course can look very much like polio. So in terms of the polio epidemic, we also know that when we introduced the vaccine, the deaths and cases of polio rose immediately. So Chicago, which is where I'm from, Cutter that makes the mosquito repellent, they were the first manufacturers of the polio vaccine that was given in Chicago. And in fact, there were many deaths and a huge outbreak of polio from the vaccine. And we're seeing this in the Uttar Pradesh today in India. There is a World Health Organization Bill Gates push to vaccinate away, eradicate polio in the Uttar Pradesh. And we have seen 47,500 cases, and probably more, because that was a year ago when I was writing this story up for grad school. We had, you know, almost 50,000 cases of deaths or paralysis from the vaccine, all vaccine-acquired polio. And there were, on average, about 12 cases of paralysis a year in that area, presumably from polio. So we went from 12 cases a year to 47,500 cases in a two-year span. And but phew, you know, they're not actually dying or being injured from wild polio. It's just the vaccine-induced polio. So, you know, it's not very clear that the polio vaccine is really what reduced polio infection in our populace.
Finally, let's take a look at how the polio vaccine was introduced to the public. Let us also ask a basic question. Is it possible they said that polio was eradicated simply because they changed the name to match other conditions so that we were still getting paralysis? We were still getting polio paralysis, but because they changed the name away from polio, we weren't counting it. That's important.
At the time, 1955, when church bells ran across America announcing that they'd now got a cure for polio, they got a polio vaccine, and is injected into a trial of over 100,000 children, with parents begging for their children to be included in the experiment.
So, nonetheless, the idea that polio is an infectious agent continued, and the vaccine was developed. And the first vaccine was an injectable vaccine that was supposed to have had all of the polio virus that was grown in the monkey kidney cells inactivated by formaldehyde. There were scientists that were saying this is going to be a problem because the way Salk is looking at the inactivation curves on the polio virus is not linear and it's not accurate. He's not keeping them immersed in formaldehyde long enough, and this is going to be a problem. But those people were ignored, and the vaccine was developed. And indeed, at the first run of the vaccine, there were significant problems with two labs that created the vaccine. One was Cutter and one was Wyeth. And Cutter is the more famous one because more children were paralyzed and died from that one than with Wyeth, but they were not the only vaccine company that had problems with their development of the vaccine. So you pretty much have a false paradigm that says polio is an infectious disease, and then you have the government developing protocols for drug companies to manufacture vaccine and not essentially overlooking every step of the way. So what happened was this vaccine was created, and there were clumps of particles still in the vaccine, and inside of those clumps, there was still live vaccine. And Salk intentionally used what he considered the most virulent form of this virus in the vaccine. And so you had live virus still in that vaccine. And when it was injected into children for the first run of it into the public after the field trials were successful, over 200 children became paralyzed and 11 of them died. Some family members were actually affected. So whatever was in this vaccine certainly did cause paralysis. And it seemed that family members who were exposed to it did get sick. But still, this was an injected phenomenon. This was nothing that was simulating anything natural. After the vaccine was developed and implemented in the population, then the job of the public health officials was to track the rates of polio and the rates of paralysis.
So I looked at the newspaper records for American states to find out how many cases of polio occurred in the vaccinated. And I found in New Hampshire, in Ohio, in New York State, the year after vaccination it was introduced, there were twice as many cases of polio in the vaccinated children as in the unvaccinated children. It had proved an absolute disaster. I think it was President Eisenhower, if I remember right, at that time. And his Secretary of State went to the vaccine manufacturers and says, we cannot have a disaster on our watch. We can't have this happen because, after all, we've announced a great triumph of American science. We've got a cure for polio.
And this is how they successfully led the public to believe that the polio vaccine is responsible for the decrease in polio. What they did is they essentially redefined the disease. And they redefined it in such a way that the polio would have actually decreased significantly even if they didn't give out a vaccine.
And this is where what I regard as wicked fraud took place. Instructions went out to California, to all the states, that non-paralytic... Now, during the polio epidemics, most cases of polio were non-paralytic, meaning the kids were not permanently paralyzed. They had enormous pain in their muscles. They vomited. They were really very ill, but they weren't permanently paralyzed. And that was called, during the polio epidemics, non-paralytic polio. All such cases, instructions went out, were in future to be called viral or aseptic meningitis. These instructions also went out in Canada, where I've seen the formal documents. Suddenly the cases of aseptic meningitis in the United States went up from near zero to over 100,000. It was declared that this was a drop in polio, and the credit was given to the vaccine. But it gets worse, because there were many kids that were paralyzed, as we all know in those epidemics, kids that couldn't even breathe and had to have iron lungs. How did they get rid of those cases? The sickening thing is they did the same way. They renamed paralytic polio. Today, you can look up health statistics internationally and in this country, and you find a disease called acute flaccid paralysis, AFP for short. Today in the United States, there are more cases of AFP than there were of polio during the great polio epidemics. It hasn't gone away. Everyone thinks it has. The vaccine's been successful. That's what everyone believes.
In addition to that, any cases of polio that developed within 30 days of a vaccine were considered pre-existing. What that essentially did was make it so that anybody who developed polio from the vaccine was considered to have a pre-existing case of polio, and any cases of vaccine failure were considered a pre-existing case of polio. So with these new criteria, they essentially wiped out polio, despite the fact that the records show that paralysis increased by 50% in the first year of the vaccine campaign and by 80% in the second year of the campaign. So they were able to get away with having increasing rates of paralysis, but showing lower rates of polio by renaming what polio looked like and changing the diagnostic criteria. And now that we have more sophisticated techniques and burgeoning fields of neurology, all those cases that were paralyzed, many of those cases that were paralyzed in the 1950s and called polio could now be called ALS. They could be called MS. They could be called hand, foot, and mouth disease. They could be called Coxsackie virus. So the differential diagnosis changed as well. So in that sense, the entity of polio seems to have gone away, but it really hasn't.
You've been listening to Dr. Susanna Humphreys, Janine Roberts, in my opinion, the finest reporter in Europe ever, Dr. Merrill Nass, and Dr. Tony Bark, all giving you input. I have filmed all of these individuals. You were listening to the audio track off of the film. The film simply asks a question, are vaccines safe and effective? Now, it's just a coincidence that I watched this video challenging Bill Gates, and unfortunately, as you heard the audience at the University of Austin, where he's funding, through his Bill Gates Foundation, a new center, he held the day because he is a prominent person. He is representative of the official position. He is the one who funds the vaccines. He's also primary funder of Monsanto because he's a primary owner of their stock. He's partnering with manufacturers. Now, I don't question Bill Gates' interest in wanting to eradicate disease, but I do question all of his methods, and I do question the safety and efficacy of all vaccines. We have a hard time in our society because most people are not scientists and don't know what the truth is or where it lies. But that's what we do. That's what this office does. We do more original investigative reporting and scientific review than any other place in the United States. So anytime that there is an issue of what is the truth, we will come forward, as you just heard, and we will offer experts fully capable of establishing a level of scholarship that can withstand critical review in a court of law. And we're saying they did not eradicate the polio virus. They simply renamed it. And today we probably have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people with illnesses that are, in fact, virtually identical to polio, but because the politics of the vaccine program, and because of an embarrassment of a government who saw that it was one giant fiasco, and because the crude methods that are non-scientific of taking human excrement and infecting it into a brain and seeing the brain of a three-year-old mouse went paralyzed or a monkey went paralyzed, and then claiming that they had a discovery. This is what happens when you commercialize science and medicine, public health. And we will continue to challenge them. As on tomorrow, I will challenge the idea of herd immunity. I will challenge this, and also on the Gardasil vaccine. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you very much for listening.